a summary of previous works on this subject. So we know that the luminal signals cannot escape the black hole. That's why the black holes are black, because nothing can come out of the horizon of the black hole. But what if you have superluminal signals? So they probably can escape the event horizon of a black hole. And the question is whether there is a similar notion of horizon for superluminal excitations. And the answer is yes. In this paper, for a static spherical symmetric solution, they showed that there is a notion of horizon for superluminal excitation. And it's important because if there is no horizon for these excitations, then in the theories with superluminal excitations, basically the classical theory is unpredictable because you have some sort of naked singularity. And even for signals with infinitely fast signals, sound speed infinite, there is a horizon which is called the universal horizon. It's universal horizon because it's universal to all signals with arbitrary speed. And for a spherical symmetric solution, it has been shown that the universal horizon at 3/4 of Schwarzschild radius at 1.5 m. So what we showed is that how the universal horizon emerges in a dynamical setting.
And this is in the class of theories you're talking about.
I'll explain the class of theories. So first, I explain the theories that we're interested in with superluminal excitations. Then I talk about the signal propagation on a curved background. Basically, if you have a field on a curved background and you perturb the field at one point, how perturbations propagate through a spacetime. If the field is the normal field, we know that it propagates inside the light cone, but if it's superluminal, it's different. And then I show you the solutions in the collapse of a spherical thin shell and the emergence of universal horizon. And I finish with some remarks on this subject. Okay, so first, about the theories with superluminal excitations. One simple example is a scalar field theory with non-canonical term. So if the Lagrangian is a function of the field itself and its first derivative to x, which is x is 1/2 grad phi squared, then the speed of sound is given by this equation, which can be bigger than 1 or smaller than 1. So you can have superluminal excitations. It can be inside this Lagrangian, yeah.
But
yeah.
Will appear also to your speed of propagation?
It's still the same. Yeah, it's completely general. It depends only on the derivative of Lagrangian with respect to x.
So potential term drops out because it doesn't depend on x.
Yeah. And one interesting limit of this theory is when the sound speed is infinite, so the term in the denominator is 0, and you get this action, which is it's called Kaskutan. It's a scalar field theory with infinite sound speed.
So do I allow imaginary actions, or are you just saying I somehow forbid either time-like or space-like? I'm not talking about signatures here.
Signature here is plus, minus, minus, minus. So
okay.
This phi surfaces are space-like.
Okay, so this is only taken seriously in uniform phi?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll just explain the relation of why this theory is interesting. So another example is Einstein ether theories, which is the unit time-like vector coupled to gravity. And here is the action of the theory, Einstein-Hilbert term, plus all possible contraction of the derivative of u, first derivative. And specifically, experimental constraints imply that the ether disturbances must propagate luminally or superluminally. So Einstein ether theories are also an example of theories with superluminal excitations. And the third example, final example is Ojala-Lipschitz gravity. It can have superluminal excitations because Ted Jacobson showed that in the IR limit of Hojava-Lifshitz is equivalent to Einstein ether theories when the ether, the vector field, is hypersurface orthogonal. So if we can have superluminal excitations in Einstein ether theories, we can have in the IR limit of Hojava-Lifshitz. And Niai showed that the IR limit of non-projectile Hojava is equivalent to Kaskutan gravity. Einstein-Hilbert action plus the action of Kaskutan. So just have to die of Kaskutan is this one. The square root of the kinetic term.
What does Kaskutan mean?
It's the Latin term for a parasitic plant, which is like grows around trees, its daughter, which is, grows around trees and then like feeds off them.
So basically,
apparently in Milford Laurier they have a botany department and they're very fond of our paper. they specialize in daughter. Excited about papers. Yes, we go to the Session Casper and Milford Laurier. Yeah, there's a botany.
So there is this relation between Einstein ether, non-projectable Hojava-Lifshitz, and Kaskutan. These theories are the same. The solution of these theories are the same when the vector field is hypersurface orthogonal, and the only non-vanishing factor here is the C2, the Einstein ether action. And these two theories are equivalent for when the potential is quadratic, and we have this relation. And in this limit, the limit of Kaskutan or non-projectile Hojava, perturbations propagate infinitely fast. And this is the theory that which we focused on. And the reason we focused on this theory because this basically is the fastest case. So the sound speed here is infinite. So if we found the horizon for infinitely fast signals, then it means that it's a still horizon for lower speed. So it's a universal horizon. Just one note about the Kaskutan. So Kaskutan satisfies a constraint equation. So it doesn't define any new dynamical degrees of freedom. It's just the constraint equation. So we are working in the limit of the largest sound speed, infinitely fast sound speed. Okay. So in this part, I'm going to explain basically when you have a scalar field. So basically, the theory we are looking at is a scalar field in the limit of becoming infinitely fast, the Kaskutan. So if you have a scalar field in a curved background, if you perturb the field at one point, how perturbations propagate through a space-time. So I start by a general action. These calculations are done in this paper. If you start by a general action, which depends on the field and its first derivative, where here G is the space-time metric with the signature plus, minus, 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 then by varying respect to phi, you can get the equation of motion. So phi satisfies this equation of motion. And this is the definition of G tilde. And then, so if I let phi to be some background value phi naught plus small perturbations at linear order satisfies this equation. So just explain the different terms here. G here, it's not the Einstein tensor. It's basically conformal factor times G tilde. So G is here. G inverse is the inverse of metric G. And the square root of minus G here is the square root of minus determinant of G inverse. M effective is some function of the background field, and CS here is the sound speed. So basically, perturbations satisfy Klein-Gordon equation. So this is the Klein-Gordon equation, but the with respect to effective metric G.
Sorry, now you've got called pi here?
So pi is the perturbation.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, pi is the linear perturbation.
So this means that you're computing the speed of sound in the conformal frame?
In the co-moving frame. So we have a Klein-Gordon equation, and we know basically the causal structure of if a field satisfies Klein-Gordon equation, we know how it propagates. So so here is the metric G inverse. So the perturbations propagate inside the cone defined by the metric by the effective metric G here. So we need to find vectors V that are null with respect to this metric, and then perturbations propagate inside this cone, which I call them propagation cone. So if you just do the calculation with G inverse, it reduces to this equation. V here is the vectors that defines the propagation cone, and G is baseline metric, C is speed of sound, and U is the normal vector to constant phi surfaces.
And I guess it's probably, is it clear that the propagations of the biggest CS squared have the outermost light cone in the sense of capital G?
Can see. So if you, so if CS becomes bigger, so let's just normalize this to one. So if CS becomes bigger, it means that U dot V becomes smaller. It means that if this is a constant phi surface and this is a normal, it means that the propagation cone becomes wider and wider. Yeah. So here we see that for CS equals to 1, this term here is 0. So it means that V is null. And the propagation cone is independent of the background field. So it's always it's the light cone. If CS is smaller than or bigger than 1, then the propagation cone depends on the background field. For smaller than 1, V is time-like. Bigger than 1, V is a space-like. So basically, to find the propagation cone, we need to find the U, which is the normal vector to constant phi surfaces. So we need to find the constant field surfaces. U in the in the case of Einstein ether is the ether field.
And that can never diverge.
It's constrained to be a time-like vector. It's a unit time-like vector in Einstein ether. Yeah.
So how you can have CS bigger from one?
So to have a CS. So this is the definition of CS. So if you have a Lagrangian, which is, has non-canonical terms, for example, so if the Lagrangian is the form of x squared plus a potential, then for this theory, CS is 1 over 1 plus 2x, the second derivative of L, which is 2, with respect to x, over the first derivative, which is 2x. So for this theory, CS squared is 1/3. For Kaskutan, L is the square root of x minus 2 pi, which the sound speed becomes infinite. And as I said, for when CS becomes larger, it means that the when CS becomes larger, it means that this value becomes smaller. For large CS, the propagation cone is almost tangent to constant phi surfaces, so it becomes wider and wider. So to see how perturbation propagates, we need to find the background field and find the constant phi surfaces, basically. So we're interested in the limit that the Lagrangian is very, so the sound speed is very big. So if you set the Lagrangian to be x to some power minus potential and set n to be very close to 1/2, slightly above 1/2, so in this limit, the speed of sound is very large. Then up to first order in epsilon, you get this equation of motion, and this is the equation of, for finding the propagation cone. And u here, it's the normal vector to constant phi surfaces. So field phi satisfies this equation of motion. And we want to find constant field surfaces of phi. So this equation of motion is basically the equation of motion for Cascutan. So just a couple of notes about Cascutan. You can think of a Cascutan as a perfect fluid with this energy momentum tensor. So energy density, pressure, and velocity vector. And it satisfies this equation of motion. Divergence of u is proportional to v prime of phi. So u is the normal vector to constant phi surfaces. And so divergence of u is the mean extrinsic curvature of that surface. So if this is phi equals constant and u is the normal, then because, OK, so.
Okay.
Okay, so
that's much better. No, you don't need to find
I think
if phi is a constant and u is the normal vector, then the mean extrinsic curvature of this surface is basically the divergence of u. Sorry? So and on this surface, the mean extrinsic curvature of this divergence of u is proportional to v prime of phi, which means it's a constant. So on a constant phi surfaces, this is constant. So it means that the constant field surfaces are the same as constant mean curvature of surface. Constant field surfaces are constant mean curvature surfaces.
Respect to the u flow.
Yeah. So we were looking for constant field surfaces, so we can instead of so it's the same as finding the CMC surfaces of the background of spacetime. If we ignore the back reaction, so if you ignore the back reaction of the field on the spacetime, then we just need to find the CMC surfaces of the background spacetime. OK, so the system we're looking at is a spherical thin shell collapse. Spacetime metric is given in this form. Inside the shell is Minkowski. Outside is Schwarzschild by Birkhoff theorem. And here are RT is the radius of shell. Shell itself satisfies the geodesic equation. So R dot is, and F here is 1 minus 2M over R. Shell radius satisfies geodesic equation. So here dot is D by DT, and E is a constant of motion, which is basically energy per unit mass of the shell. And A also here, because there can be a term here, a function of time. A is given by the fact that the induced metric on the shell is continuous. Basically, it fixes the value of A. So we can find CMC surfaces in each region, inside the shell and outside the shell, and then match them together. So here I have the normal vector to CMC surface in region 1 and region 2. And in region 2, there is a integration constant B, which we fix it by matching solutions in region 1 and region 2. B is, as I said, it's integration constant. It's constant on each CMC surfaces, but it can vary from one surface to another surface. So it only depends on the K.
I think maybe it's good to say that its physical meaning is the flux of ether across a sphere.
Yeah, if you set, so U R is, so if you set K to zero, it gives you the flux, basically. Yeah. So CMC surface in region 2 basically satisfies this equation. So if TCMC is TR, then T prime DT by DR is called this. So we need to fix the value of B and K. B is fixed by, so we have solutions in region 1 and region 2. If we require that K is non-singular on the shell, exactly on shell, then it fixes the value of B. So if you have one equation relating B to R and K. And you can label each CMC surface by its value of K or by the corresponding radius of shell, because each CMC surface crosses shell at some radius. So you can label CMC surfaces by K or R. So here is the basically the final answer. At R equals capital R, TCMC becomes the same as T-shell. And then for the region outside the shell, we basically have to integrate this. And so B is fixed through this equation, and K is fixed by matching these solutions to CMC surfaces of cosmology. So we fix K, fix B. So for each R, we can find the CMC surface. Okay, so here I have one example of, so one solution. Let me just explain. This is in the Kruskal coordinate and the same answer, the same solution in Schwarzschild coordinate.
They show the noncons there are noncons of what?
Sorry?
What are these noncons?
I'll explain. Sorry?
This is not common. These are regular noncons. The standard and the standard.
Yeah, yeah. So these are the regular Kruskal coordinates. Yeah. So this line here is the position of the shell. This one is R equals 2m. This one is R equals 0. And here I have, and these blue lines are CMC surfaces, are constant phi surfaces. And here I just plotted the ones that are outside the shell, because inside is nothing interesting happens. And I think this is not very explicit, but there is a green dashed line here, which is basically R equals 1.5m. So what happens is that different CMC surfaces act normally, and at some point, they start to stack around 1.5m. And in this region, so if you send a signal at, for example, if you send a signal at this point, it propagates on these surfaces. If you send a signal in this region, the dashed red region, then it cannot come out. Or in the Schwarzschild, if basically I draw the same thing in the Schwarzschild coordinate, so just this line is the shell surface. It's like it's back going backward in time, because basically for the horizon, this side is plus t equals plus infinity, and the other side is plus infinity. So it's like shell is going to plus infinity and then from plus infinity backward in time. So this is basically the, because the Schwarzschild coordinate is not a very good coordinate. But what happens is that the CMC surfaces are like this, and then at some point, two CMC surfaces are very close to each other, close to 1.5 m, they separate a lot. So if I draw the next one, it's a star like this, and then go up. So, and if someone sends a signal in this region, it cannot escape 1.5 m. And this effect happens basically because this term here becomes zero at 1.5 m. So T diverges logarithmically when the radius of the shell approaches some critical value.
Sorry, I'm confused. I thought the red region you didn't have access to because you don't have the CMT surfaces. So how do you even make sense of what happens afterwards?
So in this region, because we fixed the value of K by matching solutions to cosmology. In this region, I mean, if you start from this region and find the CMC surfaces, they never go to infinity. So there's no way of fixing the value of K. But
they end up in singularity.
Yeah, they end up in singularity. But for any value of K, if you draw a CMC surface, they end up at R equals zero.
I agree actually with what you say. I think the theory, I would say the theory is not well defined because you cannot draw, you cannot connect it to your boundary conditions. So the question is then, do you want to leave it in the formal level or at the physical level? So I think physically it has a problem. So though all those red dash regions, there is no CMC foliation that connects it to it.
Yeah.
Is the action, so this is Keith was asking this question about when the action is real versus
yeah. So yeah, because basically constant phi surfaces are phi is the global time of, for example, Hojava. So phi is always constant phi surface is always a space like. Otherwise, it's not a time coordinate basically. Or from the Einstein ether point of view, vector u is always time like. So it means that the phi constant phi surface is always a space like.
Can you show generically that's preserved under evolution, for example?
So here is you don't have evolution because it's, as I said, it's a constraint equation. So it's like a boundary value problem. But, yeah.
At least in this case, you know, it is because you know R equal to 1.5 m is a space-like surface. So at least all those surfaces are manifest this space.
Yeah. Didn't Ted raise an issue that at some point the things become so strongly coupled that then the ether speed diverges and it's in the context of four other issues, I think. But
I'm not sure. I don't know. And there's some issue that I think maybe it might be discussed about whether there are black holes in the Lorentz spiral theory. This is a relative general second law. But I mean, this is the one that you're talking about, I'm not quite sure.
Yeah. So, let me end by some remark. So here I showed you a solution, but we actually proved that it always happened. This result is independent of basically the initial conditions, because the initial position of the shell or the value of E, the constant of motion, so it's always happened. So one other issue is basically, is universal horizon a regular surface? So we computed the energy density and pressure of the Cascutan at the level of formation of the universal horizon, and it remains small. So the fact that we ignored back reaction, so we have a solution, so energy density and pressure remains small, so the assumption of ignoring the back reaction is correct. So universal horizon in this solution is regular, but there are arguments that if you add aspherical perturbations, they might change the universal horizon to a finite area singular surface. So you have something like this. It's a Schwarzschild R cos 1.5 is it's a singular surface.
Is it obvious that then the role of pressure and energy would always be subdivided? So if I play around and redo Choplik's exercise, when I just fine-tune my initial data so I form an arbitrarily small black hole. So is it obvious
then? Arbitrarily small, I mean?
As small as they were.
Okay, so here, this equation, I mean, these calculations are valid when black holes are, I mean, we are working in the IR limit of Poiseuille. So it's.
But you're asking what happens to critical collapse and this stuff. Yeah, well, I looked at that with my students, and David Garfinkel did independently. And what you do find is you can get critical collapse to a black hole. And there are cases where what you call the what the other horizon, what did you call it?
Which one?
The horizon.
The universe top horizon?
No. The cone. The cone.
Propagation cone.
Propagation cone. That's it. What you call the propagation cone, we call the sonic cone, basically. So the speed of sound of this stuff is bigger than the speed of light. So you can get situations where you form a black hole, and within it there so there's a region in which the superluminal matter can escape, but then the sonic horizon, the propagation horizon forms, and then it can escape. But what we always found whenever a black hole was formed was that the Cauchy problem broke down eventually. The norm of the surfaces tilts over and the whole thing stops whenever a black hole happens. And sometimes, of course, the stuff just bounces in and out. So you do have critical phenomena for this stuff.
Well, I mean, it's a somewhat different type of a stuff, I'm guessing.
Well, a little. It's the KS in small,
right.
But yeah.
But, so, I mean, what is the Choplik's problem? So it's, is it a scalar transfer theory?
And no, it doesn't matter. It's collapse of some form of matter.
I critically collapsed there. Maybe not.
It's too graphic.
If you collapse sufficient energy, then you form a black hole. If it's not sufficient, then you bounce off.
Okay, I see.
And then just look at what happens at the interface.
Yeah. That can happen with this kind of stuff.
Right. Now, I think that one assumption is we're kind of matching things to cosmology, and I think as written, the density of these are kind of tuned by the Hubble constant.
Yeah.
So as long as this is parametrically small, then the density and pressure cannot be big. Of course, then they can become big if Hubble constant is big, but then you're talking about, then you cannot talk about a sparkly flat, or you have to include cosmology at the same time as the.
But why do you have capital cosmology? Why can't you not just solve the
because basically the
is coming in? I mean, why do they have to think of matching it to anything?
Because basically the equations are boundary values, so you need to fix a boundary.
At infinity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And so, that's the thing. So for asymptotically flat boundary, the question is what do you want to match to? I mean,
you have to fix this.
So the thing is, if h is zero, then all of these vanish. If the k, h is k, right? So if you set that to zero, which would be the case for asymptotic flats, then the density of this vanishes and the pressure of this vanishes, basically, by construction. Because density and pressure are controlled by the time derivative of k and k itself. So that's kind of the practical, I guess, obstacle to cross with that. That's why I'm saying it's a little bit different from other types of fields, because it's really controlled by the what you set up. Set that to zero, then it has no
effect. Yeah. So, we also argued that this universal horizon, you should consider it as a future boundary of the classical spacetime. It's basically because of this effect that the universal horizon connects a finite time inside the black hole to infinite time outside. So it basically For example, we know that black holes can evaporate. You can, we have a Hawking evaporation, and at late times, the quantum mechanical back reactions become important. And because here we have a surface that connects finite time here to late time outside, so the quantum mechanical, if quantum mechanical back reaction becomes important here, then they're becoming important all over the universal horizon. So basically, the notion of classical space-time before reaching the universal horizon is not valid. We have to consider why after?
As
you reach the.
So, similar question this morning. So, if I then collapse and form by hand a supermassive black hole, I mean the curvature at 1.5 might be just could be extremely small.
Yeah.
So, then why would they have any quantum effect there?
Yeah, because you have signals that propagate infinitely fast, and so for example, if I continue this surface and go outside, it corresponds to late time outside the black hole. And we know that the quantum mechanical effects are important because of the Hawking evaporation process.
So things go back in time. The fact that the black hole is going to evaporate a billion years from now is going to affect things right at the universal horizon. That's because you see those surfaces go back in time, right?
But then that's dependent upon the structure of the foliation at late times outside the object. But this year, you have an explicit model. Well, but here they give away the freedom, the freedom of the foliation is they give up. They have a very particular foliation, so they have to buy with it. They have to live with the consequences.
Yeah, so we don't have a choice in picking foliation, and when you pick it, then signals can go arbitrarily fast across the foliation from one to another. That's our starting point.
Yeah, that was
firewall. Yeah, we just moved the fireball 25%
deeper. Well, but, so what happens as the black hole evaporates? Do you leave a remnant at R equals 1.5?
I mean,
of the maximum mass that it reached?
I think at this point we can't answer these questions. I mean,
right. So this is what I was trying to say. That since you don't evaporate the black hole, you can't answer. I mean. But you just said that the foliation is fixed, and so the dynamical evolution of the object post-foliation is not relevant, which to me says you should be able to answer that question. So which is it? Is the foliation really fixed as soon as you make your
tensor? Foliation is classically fixed.
Okay.
But then the statement is at some point we stop trusting classical calculations. From there on, we cannot tell what happens.
So that's it.
I thought perhaps more technical doesn't apply to Cascaton theory, but your perturbation analysis is based on finding these five constants.
What if I can't find constant phi surfaces? I mean, why? I mean, because if they are not time-like?
Yeah, or basically, it's just you cannot find surfaces with constant phi.
If it's not, if constant phi surfaces are not a space-like, then, I mean, all the calculations here are based on the fact we assume that the constant phi surfaces are a space-like. Otherwise, I mean, for example, yeah. So everything here I said, and basically this equation specifically is based on the fact that U is a time-like vector. If it's not, let's see what can happen.
Then you're going to have pieces shaded in red.
There also, I mean, You can't continue the solutions in the red region because you don't have enough boundary conditions.
Yeah, that's what,
yeah, but if you say, for example, in the red region, I set k to 0, then I can continue the solutions. So the only problem there is that you don't have...
I guess it's a global problem, not a local problem. So locally, everything is fine. Nothing goes bad. Like a very much like a regular
horizon. Right, but as you said, in one case, the boundary conditions are what determine the physics that you're going to get. So in one case, if you get too much to something that's reasonable, then you get a reasonable space time. And then inside, OK, you can pick any boundary condition, but you lose control.
It is, exactly. Right. But yeah, I think that the problem is not that the bond lab this becomes time, the surfaces become. They don't have, just, we don't know what the surface is about, so that's
fine. Yeah.
But it's not that they're necessarily time like.
Yeah. Yeah, so through all this calculation, I assume that these surfaces are space like because they are constant time surfaces of Ojava, or they are basically phi defines the ether vector, which has to be time like.
So one of the two, maybe to comment, so you mentioned this issue about where the black hole forms or not. So, I don't know. So he didn't say anything.
I think you said that at forums. So you go ahead.
About the
black hole.
Oh, black holes. So there are these arguments that if you have a Lorentz violating theory, so you have different horizon for different modes, then you can build, you can violate second law. So in this solution, it can't happen because, as I said, Kaskutan doesn't define, doesn't introduce any new dynamical degrees of freedom. And all the arguments in Tate Jacobson's argument, the assumption is that you have two different modes with different horizon, and you can basically build the particles of different these two modes. But here you can't have Kaskutan particles because Kaskutan is basically a constraint equation. So here, there is no problem with the violation of second law. But if you have a field that has finite speed of sound, then those arguments probably apply to them. So this is one advantage of having exactly infinite sound speed. You're not introducing any new dynamical degrees of freedom.
One thing that I do suspect is that you might actually form shock waves if you have finite sound speeds, because then things can catch up with each other. And actually, I mean, some of the I think probably what Rob has saw, but also there are some analytic solutions with Kaysen's field with finite sound speed that they do find singularities. So yeah, before the CS goes. So it might be that it's, CS being infinite is a special case where you don't find these shock wave singularities because it's not dynamical. But for finite sound speed, you might actually have a problem even before reaching.
And it may take place anywhere in the space. Then. It may have a singularity, a shock that forms very far from the source.
Right, exactly. So in a sense, this is the farthest that you can push things. Like,
so but if that's the case, then the theory doesn't have a way to fix itself. Like in hydrodynamics, if you have viscosity, then it might cure itself. But here, there is nothing to do.
Yes, that's right. And that's a very good point.
Okay, thanks, Manny.
Thank you.